No proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Zhanimir Rebeznoy, Donbass.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Msuya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people.
Following the failure to renew the UN brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The olive harvest season has begun in the Gaza Strip, and farmers are picking olives on their land in order to provide for their families. Palestinian farmers and their families leave their everyday routines in the middle of October and dedicate some of their time to pick the fruits of nearly a year of hard work and special care. The olive harvest season runs until early November. The tiny coastal territory used to have a thriving olive industry, but it has suffered a major setback due to years of Israeli blockade and wars, as well as the systematic destruction of olive trees. The state of Gaza's olive farmers reflects the scope of human rights violations committed by the Israeli regime against thousands of Palestinian farmers. Israel's tight restrictions have been preventing farmers from acquiring badly needed equipment for irrigation and planting.
The situation is very difficult, especially for olive farmers. It takes many years to grow olive trees, and the Israeli blockade has made it extremely difficult for us to get fertilizers and badly needed farming equipment.
The annual olive harvest season is considered a key economic, social, and cultural event for Palestinians. Olive and agriculture in general have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Farmers here are struggling to keep this vital sector alive. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
There was no mention of peace talks to end the conflict in Ukraine as NATO defense ministers met in Brussels on Thursday. Spain, one of 30 NATO countries, has pledged to supply Kiev with advanced air defense systems.
This comes on top of what other allies have delivered over the last few days. I thank all allies for their significant contributions, and I urge them to continue to step up.
Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, attended the meeting in Brussels. While he's in Belgium, who's running things back in Kiev? It's a question we put to one expert during an online interview.
The Americans, because the Americans said we are offering intelligence information, we are coordinating the flow of weapons. They direct the battlefield. They have satellites under the disposal of their military.
NATO says it has doubled the number of its battle groups in eastern regions of the alliance. More than 30 warships are patrolling the Baltic Sea and North Sea. Critics say this steady build-up in recent years is designed to provoke Russia and keep NATO relevant while pumping trillions into the arms industry. NATO's Article 5 states that an attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all of its members.
The United States is absolutely committed to its Article 5 commitments, and we are committed to defending every inch of NATO's territory, if and when it comes to that.
NATO says Russia's nuclear forces are being closely monitored. The alliance confirms it's going ahead with nuclear war deterrence exercises next week, dubbed Steadfast Noon. The drills will involve nuclear-capable aircraft, but apparently will not include any live bombs. Asked if the timing is bad given heightened tensions, NATO boss Jens Stoltenberg said it would send out the wrong signal if the exercises were suddenly cancelled now. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British government started the week with a big question hanging over its head: how to fund its billions of pounds worth of tax cuts announced last month. While it continues to tout the benefits of its controversial growth plan, in the real world, the central bank has had to intervene a third time to try to stabilize the financial markets, less than 2 weeks after Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng's announcement of his mini-budget sparked market turmoil and blistering political attacks.
Will the Chancellor now put aside his pride, do the right thing for our country, end this trickle-down nonsense, and reverse the budget?
The response from the finance minister, defiant, despite his recent U-turn on tax cuts for the highest earners.
She should get her facts right. The IMF today have said that our growth is going up.
What the IMF has also said is that high levels of inflation will persist longer in Britain than in almost all other advanced economies.
The answer they're going to try and give to this is to say, actually get the economy to grow. But it's very difficult to get the economy to grow if the rest of the world economy is actually shrinking at the moment. So if we're by cutting taxes, they say we'll get things going. Well, actually, at the moment, what they're trying to do is actually slow the economy down to control inflation. That's what the Bank of England's doing. But the government is moving in the opposite direction and adding inflation to it. This doesn't make sense to us.
The Chancellor hasn't made it clear where the cuts will fall. The National Health Service has the largest budget, but cutting that isn't realistic. The Prime Minister is committed to increase defense spending, which leaves other areas, such as education and welfare, looking vulnerable again.
Well, that was done before, when we had to go through a period of austerity, and that was very unpopular indeed. If they're going to go through that again, they're going to be very unpopular, and it's not going to be accepted, I don't think. So it's going to be interesting to see which bit they're going to try and cut. Or are they really just going to bank on growth, in which case we can't see how they're going to do it.
More than 24 million Britons live on some sort of benefit. A further reduction is unthinkable.
The UK economy shrank unexpectedly in August. Inflation is at nearly 10%, interest rates are up, pension funds are on the brink, faith in the government shaken. And with the Bank of England's intervention in the markets ending this week, is another U-turn by the government in the offing. Sai Kaur is up, London.
A general strike and civil disobedience have been observed in occupied East Al-Quds and in many areas of the occupied West Bank to reject Israel's siege on Shafat refugee camp and Anata town northeast Al-Quds. Since Saturday, the Israeli military has kept over 130,000 Palestinians in the two areas under forced lockdown after sealing all military checkpoints. The siege has disrupted residents' vital interests. It has prevented them from accessing the rest of the city for work, school and medical care and other necessities in severe violation of their basic rights. Israeli military says the move comes as they are searching for a Palestinian gunman who killed an Israeli female soldier at a checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat on Saturday.
What goes on in these actions by the Palestinians are a normal response to the Israeli brutality and aggression against Shafat refugee camp and Anata town. The strike is meant to lift the siege imposed on Shafat and Anata, Al-Quds, Qalandia refugee camp, and other towns. We all responded to the call of civil disobedience and strike.
Also on Wednesday, the Israeli forces imposed a closure on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead near an illegal settlement in the area. In addition to the major military checkpoints surrounding the city, dirt mounds have been placed on the Nablus area roads by military bulldozers to prevent Palestinians to use alternative exits. A manhunt is still underway to find the shooter. Israeli media revealed that the military was considering launching a large-scale operation in the northern West Bank in a bid to end the recent phenomena in struggle, armed struggle.
The resistance of the Palestinian people, and especially the armed resistance, as it happened in Jenin, and it moved to Nablus, and now from Nablus, we hope that it will be spreading all over the West Bank in order to resist this occupation. The phenomena that we are witnessing today in Nablus, this is the new way for the Palestinians to express their anger of this occupation, especially and particularly that all other political solutions is totally failed.
In recent months, the Israeli army have launched near daily raids to the West Bank, mainly in Jenin and Nablus, where Palestinian armed resistance is becoming more organized and new groups of fighters have been formed, the most popular now known as the Lion's Den. Despite Tel Aviv's heavy-handed crackdown and collective punishment of Palestinians, they are keeping up their resistance against the regime using different tools. Every day, the Palestinians prove that the Israeli military's aggressive measures have failed to weaken their struggle. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, in our previous episode, we talked about that parents do not have to teach their children all through just lecturing, just inculcating knowledge only. They even have to basically inculcate the knowledge through their emotions and through their actions. So you were talking on emotions and actions.
Yes, we need to, as I said, as you just mentioned, we need to teach them, inform them, make them realize, understand that is one. Of course, it's not a. It can't be done in a classroom's environment. It has to be done informally. In our discussions, we discuss with each other as parents. We discuss with our children. We discuss with them issues that pertain to our lives, yeah. Basic issues. Discussions have to be done in a free, lively environment.
Yeah.
Their knowledge of their surroundings has to increase. Their knowledge of the creations of a life has to be increased. Their knowledge of Allah Almighty, His benevolence, His mercy, His creations, the universe around us, His signs, everything has to be brought home to the child. Then the attitude, we want him to have a pure, sincere behavior for the sake of Allah. That attitude has to be inculcated through our attitude, how he sees us,
yeah,
interacting with him or her, with others, with ourselves, with our Lord, Allah Almighty. That sincerity of purpose, that sincerity of action should come through providing a living example,
okay,
to the child. How we talk to him, how we speak to him, how we communicate with him, how we show our feelings, how we the language which we use, the choice of words is very important.
Yeah.
How we make him or her feel that we love him, we love her,
care about them,
and their well-being. Whatever we want is not for our benefit; it's for their benefit. For the benefit of the family, for the benefit of the society, for the benefit of the community, of our nation. So these have to be carried out through our actions. One part of our actions is talking,
okay,
is speaking.
All right.
And how we speak. The most important form of communication that we human beings have been given. I mean, no other animal can do that. It's only us as human beings that makes us distinct.
Yeah.
Yes. We are rational animals, but we are speaking rational animals. Maybe animals communicate with each other. They may have a special form of language,
but
it's not based on rational understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the unique things which we human beings have is the competency, the capacity to communicate.
All right.
To communicate our thoughts, to communicate our feelings.
Yeah.
And they have to be done in a very beautiful way.
All right.
The child should learn from us how we communicate.
Yeah.
How the choice of words. If we want our child to behave properly, to talk properly, to speak properly.
We have to behave properly.
We want him not to abuse others, so we should not be using an
abusing language ourselves. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we're discussing how parents have to show their emotions, show their love through their actions. So, Professor Nakavi, you were saying that communication is one of the important things that needs to be happening between a parent and a child, an educator and a child. And this communication does not always happen through words. It sometimes happens through actions. It sometimes happens through emotions.
I mean, all emotions, the feelings within ourselves are beneath the surface. They are expressed in the form of actions.
Okay.
And our behavior. And broadly speaking, as I mentioned, we have two types of actions. One is speaking, and one is the other body language which we have.
Okay.
When we talk to our children, communicate with them using words, sentences, that's one form. We hug them, we kiss them, we pay respect to them. The Holy Prophet would stand up for her, Bibi Fatima to Zahra sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and show her, show his respect and love for Bibi Fatima.
Yeah.
So those are actions. So there has to be a combination of words, mm-hmm. sentences, language, and other actions which are performed through the other parts, the whole body actions which we have.
So you're basically trying to say that when we speak to our child, the speaking must be done through words and also our body language. Our body language also speaks, like you said, in a nation.
So we need skills to do that. The proper skills have to be employed.
Yeah, you give a very beautiful example in a nation where girls were buried alive. In that nation, Prophet even taught through actions to the entire nation, giving respect to his daughter, standing in respect for her, especially in a nation which was very, very backward in terms of burying daughters alive. So we have to, like, through our actions, we cannot even, just the example you mentioned, we cannot even teach just only our children. We can even, like, whosoever is around, we can even teach them, like our society, our neighbors, our relatives.
Exactly. Basically, the very important thing which must be kept in our minds and remembered is that Allah Almighty says, "Karramna bani Adam." We have created human beings with dignity.
All right.
The basic thing which has importance, which is of paramount importance, is the dignity of human beings.
Okay.
Allah Almighty says, human beings have been created by me by breathing into them from my very soul. The dignity of mankind is because of nafakhtu fihi min ruhi.
All right.
We human beings have been created as manifestations of God's excellence in creation.
Yeah.
So this dignity has to be maintained.
All right.
Our own dignity and the dignity of our children.
Yeah. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, a man once came to the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam and said, I have never kissed a child. When he left, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, this is someone who, in my view, is one of the people of hell.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're saying how parents can show their love to their children through their emotions and actions. Yes, Professor Naqvi.
So, as I was saying, human dignity, after one's life, the most important thing after the human life is precious.
Yeah.
And after that is the dignity of the human being.
Yeah,
the issue of the girls who were buried alive by their parents.
Yeah,
the worst thing that could possibly happen.
True.
Abhorred by the Holy Prophet, as we know that a person came to the Holy Prophet. He had become a Muslim believer, but he wanted to confess that before I became a Muslim, I made this terrible
mistake.
This terrible,
actually, a sin.
This sin. And how can I be redeemed? The Holy Prophet, of course, becoming a Muslim would go a long way in redeeming him. But still, the Holy Prophet was not able to continue to, you know, look at him. He wanted, he wasn't so put off by that sin that was done before Islam.
Yeah.
So both things are involved in that. The very dignity of girls was trampled upon in the times of ignorance.
True.
As it is today, trampled upon in other forms.
In other forms, in other ways. Violating their human rights.
I mean, the hijab.
Yeah.
Is to preserve dignity.
True.
Now, if some women burn their scarves, take off their scarves, they are trampling upon their own dignity.
True.
And beyond that, in that case, because they have no dignity, their precious lives are taken away.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
Yeah, even today.
Even today.
Yeah.
Becoming objects of human temptations.
Yeah.
They are led to be murdered sometimes.
Yeah.
So therefore...
And that's the biggest form of human rights violation, that you have to represent yourself, you have to show off yourself through your body, not through your intellect. Exactly. You have to suffocate your intellect, you have to kill your intellect and your intelligence, your knowledge, but you have to show off who you are through your body. That's the biggest form of human rights violations towards girls.
So when we're talking about our children, especially, the human dignity involved there is, has to be maintained. It has to be kept intact. By scolding, telling off our children all the time, we are suppressing their dignity.
All right. So through our actions and through our emotions, we have to basically show off them the love that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given in within us, as you verily mentioned the verse that He has breathed into us from His own very own soul. And also, like, we must always think that, are we the creatures for whom He said, فَتَبَارَكَ اللَّهُ الْخَالِقِينَ, and indeed I'm the best of the creators. So yes, we have to keep all that in mind. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
In what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The rally against the soaring living costs and climate inaction has been held in the French capital, Paris. This might as well take place in many European cities that have been plagued by the same crisis, namely a cost of living crisis. Why are European countries not able to resolve their economic problems? Is it purely because of a lack of energy and high inflation? And is this all because of the Ukraine conflict? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will dig deep to see if European politicians, like the ones in France, are prepared to make sacrifices for their citizens and not just follow the U.S. lead. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Paolo Raffone joins us. He's the Secretary General at the SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, George Samioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute at the London Metropolitan University, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Paolo Raffone. Looking at what has happened in France, you're looking at, first of all, the protests, which the really huge, it was a huge protest. 140,000 is the tally they showed, that people came out and they basically marched against what was called the rising cost of living and government inaction against climate change. If you saw the protests, what do you think? And what do you think about the two causes that they came out for?
Well, the protest was quite huge. Well, France is a big country. There were protests also in other parts of Europe, for instance, in Brussels, where I live, was much more modest, where 4,000 people more or less. But anyway, it was significant. I think it is the beginning of a process all over Europe. People are tired of leaders who are supporting on the humanitarian ground a country that has been aggressed, but on the other side, they are destroying the daily life of people in Europe, and huge amounts of money are diverted towards the war issues, even if it is for humanitarian reasons, but it is not only, as we know, it's for armaments as well. And people are tired. I mean, they just came out of 2 years of pandemic, and they do not want to listen to this kind of approach any longer, and they're taking the streets. This is the beginning, in my opinion.
George Samioli, is this the beginning?
I think so. The cold weather will soon be hitting Europe. It's still been relatively mild, but it's obviously coming very soon. And already we've seen the soaring energy prices throughout Europe. People are unable to pay their bills, their electricity bills, their gas bills. And given also the enormous pressure coming from rising inflation, you've got the a truly powerful, explosive mix. And once people suddenly start feeling cold and they're feeling hungry, and if, as is likely, a recession is also coming, that means they're also going to be out of work and out of money, then there is going to be a very, very bitter winter.
I'm curious, Paolo Raffone, if the politicians, if the ones who are in the governments, who are in power, are looking at these protests, and I'm wondering what they're thinking. I mean, do you think that they're looking at it, and are they going to come out with any kind of explanation as to what they should prepare the general public for?
Well, they're trying to say half sentences, but in fact, people do not trust them any longer. All of them, I mean, in all countries and at European level. I mean, the way they've been handling the pandemic before and now the issue of this war has demonstrated their incapacity, and people are really tired of this. Now, how this will materialize, in which political form or social form, is difficult to say. There will be more protests, as the other colleague was saying, because of the conditions of living which are deteriorating, and the more it will be in the coming months. So how this will materialize in political terms is difficult to say, but certainly people are discouraged, upset, and disenchanted. And this is not a good mix.
The protests that occurred in France, George Samioli, it's interesting that one of the major reasons for it was what they call the climate crisis. I'm just curious how much that really holds in the bigger picture when we're looking at European governments talking about gas rationing, electricity blackouts. I mean, green energy, if you have an electric car, how can you even pump it with, I shouldn't say pump it, charge it with electricity when you can't afford to pay the bill, electric bill?
I agree with you. I think the current energy crisis obviously has been brought on in part by the sanctions policy that was directed at Russia, and then Russia retaliating by essentially cutting off gas for Europe. But it's actually of long standing, and I think it's come about because the countries of Europe have for years not invested enough in fossil fuels. They listened too much to Greta Thunberg and the whole idea of moving towards renewables without really thinking through of how feasible this is and how this plan can possibly be bear fruit anytime in the near future. And so because they haven't invested enough in fossil fuels, because also during the pandemic, they didn't replenish their gas supplies, which they should have done because the economy was going to recover and therefore there would be a great demand on gas. Because they've neglected all of this, they've now got themselves into a mess because then they decided to impose sanctions on one of the biggest energy producers in the world without thinking through those consequences. Well, when you've made so many bad decisions, you are going to suffer the consequences. And I think people are going to express their rage against their political leaders.
So since you're talking about Russia there in terms of being obviously a gas producer, Paul Raffone, I don't think it's the best route to go at this point, given what we've seen so far, for the U.S. leading European countries into having this war drag on against Russia, which is the number, I think it's the number two producer or number one producer, and then U.S. getting into a spat with Saudi Arabia, the number two producer. So you got the first two out of the way. We know how they feel about Iran, and I think we know how they feel about Venezuela also.
Well, definitely the nonsensical management of this crisis by the United States has only one scope, or it looks like having one scope, that is destroying Europe. And which is a nonsensical scope as well, because if they destroy Europe, they lose the best friend that they had in the world and also the best ally they had. So I simply cannot understand what Americans are up to. Do they really think they can continue governing the world in a unipolar way, imposing their rule everywhere? Or it would be better, as I would suggest, to find a common ground with some kind of compromise with the different types of powers which are not emerging, they are existing. So it's time to wake up and to see the reality.
Who has to wake up? Are you referring to the Europeans?
Europeans and United States, both.
Well, George Samioli, why aren't the Europeans waking up? I mean, first of all, they've come out, both France and Germany, the French, recently, just days ago, the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, saying, wait a minute, the U.S. is making out big time, profiting off the gas sales to Europe. At the same time, he has said that this shouldn't be at the behest of the weakening of Europe. I mean, the news is already out there in terms of what is called deindustrialization. I'm sure you've heard of it. Many factories are relocating from Europe into the U.S., so if I'm European officials, aren't they seeing that happen? I mean, at this point, they should say, wait a minute, they're selling us gas, making us huge profits. They're selling us weapons. It seems like the U.S. is not really investing in the war, but the Europeans are somewhat paying for it.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's obviously been the case, really, from the beginning. It was the United States from the start that has instigated this war. It has pushed Ukraine into taking extreme positions that was bound to cause deep anxiety among Russia. Despite, and then when Russia issued warning after warning that you're crossing a red line, you're crossing a red line, the Americans continued to push Ukraine. And it should have been obvious even then to the Europeans, who were by no means that enthusiastic about the idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO, it should have been obvious to them that this war will benefit the United States and Europe not at all. And so Europe was kind of pushed into this confrontation, but the United States, which is, of course, a big energy producer of its own, United States could cope with it, but Europe doesn't produce energy, or at least not very much energy, and Europe was going to be in the front line. And so for the French now to say, and the Germans as well, oh, the Americans are making out like bandits on liquefied natural gas. Yeah, well, that should have been obvious that that was always the plan. I mean, the Americans were pushing the Germans already years ago under President Trump to cancel Nord Stream 2. And the Germans went along with it, even though Nord Stream 2 was clearly benefiting the German economy. And by essentially canceling it, Germany has essentially shot itself in the foot. So, you know, it's an unfortunate fact that the Europeans have not shown the kind of leadership that previous generations of European leaders, such as Charles de Gaulle, Willy Brandt, Helmut Schmidt, Helmut Kohl, had shown when they defied the Americans. Because this is a long-standing issue about Europe getting its energy from Russia, or before that with the Soviet Union. The Americans have always tried to thwart this, but European leaders used to have the gumption and the guts to stand up to the United States, but no longer, unfortunately.
Try to break that down for us, Paolo Raffone, if they don't have the willpower to stand up or the guts to stand up to the U.S. What does that exactly mean? I mean, their citizens are suffering and they're losing money. So tell us what that means. Why can't they do that?
Why they can do that? Because the economic and financial system that has been imposed worldwide and in Europe in particular over the past 30 years has created a bunch of yes men educated in the same schools with the same set of mind. And so we do not have any more leaders capable of thinking on their own and to stand up, as the colleague was saying, for the previous old ones, which does not mean to be against the United States, but just to say, well, look, we also have our needs. We are allies. We want to be friends, but we cannot commit suicide. And our leaders are incapable, completely incapable of doing this, particularly on the leftist side. The left has completely lost the capacity of thinking anything which is leftist. And so the only thing that is coming out is this kind of nationalistic or populistic kind of reaction, which is a way to react, of course, but not necessarily the best one to stand up to the United States.
You mentioned Nord Stream, and I have to ask you, George Samueli, do you think the U.S. was responsible for that? I mean, they did the probe. They said there was an act of sabotage that took place. And, of course, we can't forget how Joe Biden earlier in the year had said that we would do what we would stop Nord Stream from operating. How do you see that particular thing that happened?
Well, as always, when there's a crime, the first question you have to ask is qui bono, who benefits? And whoever benefits is the primary suspect. In this case, the United States, which from one administration to another, has been determined to sabotage Nord Stream 2, obviously benefits. And Russia, which it's Russia's property, it's a revenue stream for Russia, it's a system of leverage for Russia. Russia stands to benefit not at all from this crime. Germany stands to benefit not at all from this crime. So you'd have to say, the likeliest suspect is, of course, the chief beneficiary. And one has to say, the United States hasn't exactly gone out of its way to deny its culpability. Yes, to be sure, it has denied it. But, if it really wasn't responsible, if it really believed that the Russians were behind this, you bet that the Americans would be screaming at the top of their voices, pointing their fingers at Russia. They haven't done that. So you have to say that, you know, they are the likeliest suspects, and their relatively mute response is just further evidence of that.
Paolo Raffone, so looking from this point on forward, I'm trying to paint, or you are going to try to paint a scenario for us of which I'm going to put forward some analysis of some of the facts put together. When we take a look at the state of the economy of European countries, do you think it would be justified to compare what is happening now to what happened back in 2007, 2008, when the financial crisis broke out, in terms of the strength of the European economies? Because as it stands, it seems like European countries are basing profits on projections of how they're going to, I guess, generate revenues. But the revenues are just not happening. Perfect case in point, I think, would be the UK, where they were projecting £60 billion in savings over the course of, I think it was 5 years, but on a 2.7 or 8% GDP growth. But at best, it is said that they're going to grow at 0.7 or 8 tenths of a percent. So that, how are they going to come out of this if the growth is not going to be there, if the revenues are not going to be there for the governments?
It would be horrific and painful at social level, because they will, the governments will have to cut spending. That's the reality. I mean, they're talking about a sort of a European mutualization of costs of this situation, but this is a sort of a pipe dream and goes nowhere. The reality is that for the next few months, probably the situation will increasingly go worse, but not that bad. But during next year will be catastrophic, and especially after the next summer. So how they will respond, I have no idea. I just see a sort of improvisation and a very weak and incapable leadership at all levels.
Mm-hmm. George Samueli, looking forward, if we are to see the disintegration of these economies in one way or another, because at this point it's a somewhat blanket application that we can make on the European countries, if you agree, then we are looking at the Eurozone on very shaky grounds, not that it was on solid grounds before. Do you see this, what's the worst case scenario you see coming up if the Europe continues down this track?
Well, I think obviously serious social unrest will be the first consequence. We're already seeing this in France. You know, there were these big demonstrations today, but there's also a big strike. There's going to be more and more of these strikes, because when you have inflation, then people are continually taking pay cuts, and then people obviously respond very badly to pay cuts. But there's obviously going to be serious social crises at the economic heart of Europe, which is Germany, because Germany, you know, powers the European economy. And if German industry will have to start laying people off, if German industry is going to start having to close down factories, industrial plants, moving their factories out of Germany into the United States, then you're really going to have a problem. Because the one thing that the Germans have been very proud of since 1945 has been their economy, that the fact that they produce high quality goods that have absolute extraordinary reputation throughout the world. And if they can't produce that anymore, if they are become an economic basket case, the kind of basket case such as Greece that the Germans tend to mock, then you're going to see real distress. And when the Germans get distressed, then really serious consequences.
So if you were to take a look, Paolo Raffone, at the suggestion that the U.S. maybe has this intention, which is, we don't know for sure, but we're seeing that happen in Europe, where out of Germany, for example, companies or factories, I should say, are relocating to the U.S., even though the U.S. and I think Europe or European Union has about $5 trillion in trade between the two. Are we looking at the U.S. really moving forward with that intention in mind when it comes to Europe, where at the end it's going to reap the benefits, but at the cost of Europe?
In part, it is like this. I mean, certainly the neocon group, which is, as you know, transversal between the two main parties in the U.S., which is at the origin of all this dramatic crisis in Europe, has this in mind. I mean, to have Germany pay and Europe continue to pay, because finally Europe has a huge amount of money saved and not invested. So they want to transfer this money in the U.S., which is now printing new money but without savings. So this is certainly their idea. But now, the neocons, will they survive after the 8th of November? This is a question mark, because what will happen probably is that they will be decimated, and a totally different policy will be shaped in the United States. We will see what happens. But certainly what we have seen done by the Democrats and Biden so far will not continue after November. I mean, there would be necessarily a change, at least in one part of the Congress, but probably in both. So if this happens, there will be a U-turn also in the United States in terms of policy, and the neocons may be marginalized in some way or another.
All right, last question. I'm going to have to get a reaction from you, George Samioli, because it has taken social media by storm. And that is when the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said, Europe is a garden and the rest of the world is a jungle, where he said the jungle could invade the garden and that the gardeners have to go to the jungle to protect the garden.
In terms of Josep Borrell, he has a tendency to say imbecilic things because he is an imbecile. But I think probably what he meant is that we in Europe have a very, very nice life, but it's been a very privileged life that we've enjoyed. Cheap energy from Russia, the German economic miracle, with its export-driven economy, and it may all soon come to an end. That 50, 60, 70 years that the Europeans have enjoyed, that comfortable life, may very soon be coming to an end. I think probably that's what he was trying to articulate.
Yeah, we'll leave that to the history books, too. We'll find out how that pans out. Thank you. That was George Samioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of SIPPI Foundation from Brussels. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.